I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Last year, Charlie Demers wrote Theatre Replacements in East Van Panto, which was a production of Jack and the Beanstalk, set in East Vancouver. The team of Mr. Demers, the writer, Veda Hilly, its composer and musical director, and Emil Gladstone, the director, are back for Cinderella in East Van Panto, set on Fraser Street. Charlie Demers joins me now. We'll talk about this new production and more. I'll get him to tell us what a panto is. It's a show for all ages, and knowing the team behind it, it'll be a riot and entertaining. The show stars Josh Drebit, James Long, Don Petten, Donna Soares, and Alan Zinnick, with Bailey Soleil Creed, Olivia Ann Hutt, and Alexandra Weber. Cinderella in East Van Panto runs from the 3rd to the 28th of December at the York Theatre on Commercial Drive. It's a great venue. Visit tickets.theculch.com to buy tickets. Charlie Demers is an author, comedian, playwright, and a new dad. He teaches at the University of British Columbia's Creative Writing Department, and you can hear him from time to time on CBC Radio's The Debaters. You can follow him on Twitter, at Charlie Demers is his handle. Please welcome back to the Plant Outline program, Charlie Demers. Mr. Demers, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. Thanks for having me back. It's a pleasure to be back on the show.
And since you were last on, you've become a father, is that right?
I have become a father to baby Josephine, named for host of the commentary, Plant on the Line, Joseph Planta.
I thought it was named after Stalin.
Oh, yeah, well, those two, yeah.
Stalin,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah, it's an old, it's a family name. It was kind of a tribute to my dad, whose middle name is Joseph, and then we found out that, I knew that she had one great-great-great-grandmother named Josephine, but it turns out from that same generation she had two. So it's an old family name, but it is highly adaptable if we need to claim that she's named after somebody.
Yeah, so what's it like being a dad?
Well, you know, today's not the best day to ask because last night was a tough one. The poor little thing has, a bit of a cold, but it's a bit of a cold that's been kind of dramatically magnified in our parental minds, because she was held last night by someone who kind of casually, after holding her for 20 minutes at a party, mentioned that they were waiting for results on a TB test. So that's the kind of thing that being a parent is like. Just anyway, it's the greatest. She's fantastic, you know, and I'm hoping to get to bring her to the show this year. She was supposed to be born during the run last year, mm-hmm. and I thought I could safely put that in the program, that she would be born at some point during the run, because her due date was December 22nd, and the show ran for the same, basically the same dates last year as it did this year, and she was so late that the show was, you know, shuttered, and all swept up and no trace of it left by the time she arrived on the scene. So I'm looking forward to taking her in to see some of it this year.
So this is the first Christmas then?
This will be her first Christmas, yeah. She was, well, that was the other thing, right? If she was a Christmas baby, we could have claimed that Josephine was, you know, after St. Joseph. There was, yeah, she was due the December 22nd, and then we thought, maybe she'll arrive on December 25th, you know, have the same birthday as the two sons of God, Jesus Christ and Justin Trudeau. But in the end, she decided that this was going to be her first Christmas. So, yeah, we're very much looking forward to it.
Yeah, it'll be exciting, I'm sure. I guess kids at one can sort of tell what the deal is. But, I mean, for you guys, for mom and dad, that'll just be...
Yeah, it's I mean, I get a kick out of watching her, you know, eat a yam fry. So Christmas is definitely going to be special.
So I went and saw Jack and the Beanstalk last year, and I thought it was hilarious. And so critically, it was a smash. It did well otherwise, didn't it?
I think so. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for the kind words. And yeah, I think they were happy with how it went. We were getting people out to something that was pretty new. The panto is not a super well-known tradition yet in Vancouver. It goes through, I should say, ebbs and flows in the kind of consciousness of audiences out here. And we were bringing people into the newly refurbished York, which everybody was super excited about. So it was kind of one of those great kind of synergies, the two things sort of overlapping. And so, yeah, I think they were really happy with the crowds last year, and we were really happy with the response, both from critics and from the crowds.
And so you guys are back this year with Cinderella.
Yeah.
You're the playwright, so in terms of writing a panto, and explain to us what a panto is. You're taking a story like Jack and the Beanstalk or like Cinderella,
yeah,
and you're revamping it. What are you doing?
So a panto is primarily a British theatrical tradition. It's usually a holiday show, a Christmas show, but not Christmas themed. And it tends to be an adaptation of one of, generally speaking, there are five fairy tales or children's stories that get adapted. And I always forget a couple of them, and one's kind of a British one that never really made it over here, mm-hmm. but it's usually Aladdin, Jack and the Beanstalk, Cinderella, Puss in Boots, or, you know, little Jack Helmingsworth and his steak and kidney pie, or whatever it is. It's, you know, some really incredibly British title. Anyhow, the story is kind of adapted in a kind of what's meant to be an irreverent and kind of localized way. So there's usually references to contemporary politics and references to the location of the panto. There's usually a fairly strong strain of kind of body mm-hmm. Humor that's supposed to go over the heads of the kids in the audience and be for the grown-ups. So it is supposed to be kind of an all-ages show, and the idea being that hopefully you're kind of firing on enough different cylinders that everybody is kind of into the situation at any given time.
So Cinderella is on Fraser Street, is that right?
Yeah, last year, you know, there was some observations that the East Van Panto was very commercial drive-centric, which mm-hmm. it was. And so we are, you know, expanding the scope. I've also, you know, we also have that news of that, you know, $2 million house selling on just off Fraser Street a month or two ago. And
yeah.
So we figured, well, we better get Fraser Street while it's still culturally part of East Van, you know, before it's annexed to Carisdale or Kitsilano or something. So, we set it on Fraser Street, and then Veda does a sort of adapts usually existing songs, familiar songs, rewrites the lyrics, and this year the music is it's off the hook. It's as you mentioned, we have three additional cast members from Studio 58, mm-hmm. Which has made it so that we can really fill the stage with sound and movement, with, you know, these dance numbers and singing. Last year, I thought we did very well with the five people that we had, but this year, you know, to have eight, it really makes a difference. And I saw the first full, you know, top to tail run through in rehearsal last week, and the music and the dancing are just out of sight.
The other thing that I got from last year's show, and I'm sure it'll come through in this year's show, is the sense that, I mean, Vancouver has a lot of problems, and living here can be a pain in the ass sometimes, and
yeah.
and it can really run you down. Because it's kind of expensive, but I get the sense, and this is probably from you, the author, that you like living here.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, if you love a place enough, you've got to hate it at least a little bit. It just means that you take the place seriously, or it's in your bones. Vancouver is my home, and in a not just the kind of straightforward geographical spatial way, or even in the sense of whatever the sort of accidents of autobiography that have kind of had me here and kept me here for my whole life. But it's also my home, and that it's kind of, I don't know, it's in the pocket for me. This is where I feel most comfortable working creatively. Like a lot of the work that I've done, last year's Panto, this year's Panto, Vancouver Special, the Book of Essays, a lot of it has to do very specifically with the city. I love living here, and I think living here is, involves really being frustrated with living here some of the time as well. And you get frustrated about what's happening to the city because you love being here so much. So, when you're looking at, well, could we live in New Westminster? Could we live someplace else because the city where we live is getting out of reach? That's the kind of thing that makes you angry because you want to stay. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite kind of love songs about a city is The Weaker Than's "I Hate Winnipeg," which is always trotted out as an anti-Winnipeg song because people only ever listen to choruses. It's the same, it's Born in the USA syndrome. Mm-hmm. But "I Hate Winnipeg" is all about, how much he loves the city and how really only the people who really love a place can kind of have the right to complain about it.
And then the work of the satirist, the comedian, I guess, it is a kiss and two slaps to whatever you're talking about, right?
Yeah, it's a kind of roast of Vancouver, I guess, in a certain way. Last year we really, with Jack and the Beanstalk, we really went after the kind of real estate situation. So we kind of we wanted to back off of that, back off a little bit from that this year. But we're sending up the things we love about the city and also the things that are not so hot.
Without giving up some of the jokes that'll be in the show, you talked about how some of the material, and it is timely. What are some of the things that you send up?
Without tipping my hand too much, yeah. I can tell Panto goers that they should expect to see at least at one point in the show a dancing pipeline. our Cinderella's the prince's father, the king, is based on our new guest, Donald Trump, and his Trump Towers, Vancouver.
Yeah.
What else is going on? We've got a little bit of for lovers of BC Ferries. I won't spoil how that shows up, but there'll be a little bit of something in there for you. And last year the show was narrated by a real estate agent, and this year it will be narrated by a street canvasser.
Ah.
Yeah.
There you go. Would you talk to me about what sort of humor comes out of, say, current events and how one would write? Like, I mean, is it too? I mean, I guess it's not too soon to joke about Gian Gomeshi.
Well, I don't know. I tried to. I mean, there will not. I can tell you, there will not be any Gian Gomeshi jokes in our children's play.
Okay.
I did try to tell a joke last week on stage, and I think partly I bungled it. I don't know that there's anything funny about well, I mean, I think I can say for certain that there's nothing funny about what he did.
Yeah.
There are, however, ironies and incongruities in his hypocrisy, in the way that he handled it, that sort of thing. And I think that kind of thing is fair game. So I think, you know, the joke that I was trying to tell last week was just about how, you know, it kept coming up in all of the interviews. All of these witnesses were saying, or victims were saying, that he was always asking them if he was too fat.
Yeah.
That this was this weird kind of preoccupation that he kept saying, you know, am I fat? Am I too fat? And I just, so my joke was basically, you know, as a fat guy, how much it hurts to learn that the worst guy in the country, his greatest fear is just ending up like you, you know, and like this idea of, you know, oh, is my face a little puffy? The worry more about being a monster,
yeah.
Leon. I don't know. I'd like to take another run at that. I think there's something there. I'd like to be able to make it work. But yeah, I think that there's. It's all about really kind of intention and where the joke is coming from.
Yeah.
When it's too fresh, you know, I took a tweet down. One of the nights, you know, early into things when the story was just breaking. And I put up a tweet that said, you know, why isn't anyone taking seriously the possibility that the one jilted ex-girlfriend has cloned herself into mm-hmm. multiple accusers? And to me, the joke there was obviously, you know, how pathetic a shell this jilted ex story was, to me that joke was an angry joke about Gomeshi and aimed at him, and you know, because for me, if I make a joke about something, I mean, that's just how I process it, and so I don't view it as making light of the thing. Mm-hmm. For me, actually, that joke came from a place of being furious, but it was interpreted by some people. Well, by one person. I really only heard from one person, but I decided to take it down because I didn't want to be misunderstood. You know, basically saying, you know, please, no jokes now. This is not. I wanted to respect that, and I also didn't want to try and insinuate myself into the situation and try to make it about me. I mean, it's not an opportunity for jokes, you know, as those things are breaking.
We're talking on a Wednesday morning when he's been arrested, he's been charged, and he's out on bail.
Yeah, the whole country is kind of just on tenterhooks waiting to see what's going to happen the first time he says, well, hi there, happy Thursday, in the prison cafeteria.
So I was thinking of a joke. Because we're also seeing a lot of people being arrested on Burnaby Mountain.
Right.
And I've been racking my brain, and I guess that's why I'm not a comedian, is because I can't think of it. But I think you would think that there'd be something there.
Well, I mean, for people who think, you know, you can never make these jokes, I mean, I think people are pretty glad that Hannibal Buress made the jokes that he made about mm-hmm. Cosby, even though, you know, they were very dark and hard to hear. That's really seems to be what pushed that story or those stories past the tipping point. So it's a delicate thing. I mean, I always think so much of it comes down to intention. It comes down to who's the butt of the joke. Who does it land on? And I think as long as you're telling a joke about Gian Gomeshi that lands on his hypocrisy, his monstrousness, his ego. I think those kinds of things are fair game, but there's no guarantee, right? I mean, it's all the audience will let you know what they're ready for, and you just kind of have to be able to feel that out.
And you mentioned Cosby. By the way, were you a Cosby fan?
As a kid, I I love the show. I was born in 1980, so I was like right in the kind of groove for the sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
I can say it's irrelevant to how I feel about any of the allegations, but I was never a fan of his stand-up, mm-hmm. which he's viewed as being one of the masters, but I always just found it too, I was talking to someone and they just said they found his stuff just so silly, and I guess I found it that way as well. I've always preferred Richard Pryor or Dick Gregory. I guess those are the three kind of major sort of figures of 60s African American, crossover stand-up breakthrough acts. And they're always just seemed more to me in Pryor and in Dick Gregory. I recently rewatched that clip from Raw where Eddie Murphy is talking about the phone call he got, this famous phone call that he got from Bill Cosby, chewing him out for using profanity on stage, and then he calls Richard Pryor to see what, and Richard Pryor always came off great in that story.
Yeah.
Now he comes off like, I don't know, it's just that like just kind of magically centered, like just the self-righteousness on Cosby's part in that, it just comes off so much more. I don't know. It was watching that clip from Raw was really it felt much more powerful than it did the first time I saw it.
And this is, I mean, as a comedian, has this been a tough year? I mean, two prominent comedians, Joan Rivers and Robin Williams, died.
Yeah.
When stuff like that happens, when people pass in your profession, does that affect you, the work? I mean, I know Robin Williams did.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough, right? I mean, there's different kinds of, for Cosby or for Woody Allen, these are sort of men who are, in the DNA of stand-up comedy. They're sort of legends, and then they become monsters, or they become revealed as having been monsters, and then you've got to reckon with that. And I think that's a very different feeling. Although it is a form of loss, it's a different feeling from losing someone like Joan Rivers, or for me especially, Robin Williams. Robin Williams was, as I said, when he died, I mean, there was no, for someone my age, you can't, I could not have named a bigger, more important figure in the world of comedy, just at its various levels, in terms of improv, in terms of stand-up, in terms of film and television acting, than Robin Williams. I mean, he was beyond, supernova big, and I got to do a show with him, just a few years into doing stand-up comedy, and it was for me it was such a kind of watershed night. To we were doing the 9th anniversary show at the Urban Well, and I was performing as part of a comedy duo that I was in at the time with Paul Bay, called Bucket. Brent Buck was hosting, he brought us up, we did our set, Robin Williams watched it, he got up on stage and was talking about us, and he made a joke, because Paul's Korean and I'm white, he made a joke about how, as an interracial comedy act, we were the future of comedy. And afterwards, after the show, we were taking a picture with him, and he says, we said to him, you know, listen, don't be angry if that quote shows up out of context on all of our publicity materials, and he just goes, future comedy, right, letting us know that, that we could use it, you know, giving us his blessing, and, you know, it was, as I've said before, it was the first night that, in relation to comedy, you know, I lost my mother when I was very young, and I think about her all the time, and I wish she was here all the time. It was the first time in relation to comedy that I remember thinking, like, okay, I wish that my mother could have been here for tonight, you know, because it was the absolute ceiling of, like, who you would ever get to rub shoulders with, or who would get to see you perform. So, I mean, that was gutting news. That was gutting news to learn that when he died, and it was very sad as well when Joan Rivers died. I mean, Joan Rivers, you have to at least acknowledge that she got to live that, you know, the full arc of a life, in a way that Robin Williams kind of didn't, which doesn't take away from the sadness, but maybe takes something away from the tragedy of it. You know, she was incredible, too. I mean, I saw her once, you know, a friend of mine said, I got tickets to Joan Rivers, do you want to come? And I said, of course. And it turned out not to be stand-up. It turned out to be one of those, like, you know, motivational speaking, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, at the center downtown before it became a church. And, you know, so it was one of these speaker series where, like, you know, Madeleine Albright and you know, Queen Noor of Jordan and then Joan Rivers or whatever comes to town. So anyway, Joan Rivers is there. She's speaking to an audience of, you know, it's my friend and I, two men in our 30s, and then literally everyone else there is a 57 to 73-year-old white lady.
Yeah.
And she's just, and so a lot of it was not straightforward comedy, but, you know, that's how her mind worked, and so she would revert to, and, you know, there was a point where she goes, she's taking, anyway, she's talking about ejaculate, she's talking about cum, and then she says, she's talking about swallowing it, and then she stops and says, which is four Weight Watchers points. And, I mean, the audience just, they lost their minds. And, it, I mean, rightfully so. It's a hilarious line. She also, you know, somebody asked her, there was a Q&A from the audience, and people said, you know, did you, what was your childhood like? And she says, I don't know. I mean, I had a good childhood, I think. I wasn't raped. I rode a bike. And it was just such a kind of pithy sort of, and to me, again, that's a rape joke that I think works, because it's sort of about, it's not really a joke about rape, it's a joke about what's our threshold now for what a good childhood is, where do we set the bar, and it's kind of, it's a joke about how horrifying childhood can be underneath the surface, and so I thought it was, you know, it certainly that night hit a sweet spot with the crowd. So, I mean, I think for people like Robin Williams, for people like Joan Rivers, there's a sadness, but it doesn't ever grind the comedy to a halt. I don't know what the effects of the Cosby stuff are right now on the comedy world. I think it, to be honest, I'm grateful that it was a comedian who called him out, because I feel like if it weren't, we might be seeing some uglier kind of wagon circling responses from comics.
Yeah.
And then for somebody like Woody Allen, Seven is so weird. Like, I literally, like, I had a dream about Woody Allen last night, like, you know, about some of this stuff. Because for me, there's no one, I mean, there was no one who was more sort of key to my development. I mean, you and I, we've talked about Woody Allen, I think, every time that I've been on the show.
Yeah.
He's kind of a shared, you know, touchstone. And he was my, like, he was one of the prime reasons I started writing. He was one of the major reasons I started doing stand-up. For the first few years, I was just doing his voice almost, you know, to a T. Those kind of surrealist, absurdist short stories in books like Without Feathers, that was the kind of stuff that made me want to be a humorist.
Yeah.
And so the difficult thing was kind of acknowledging, well, like, well, here's this very compelling and believable story, and here are the holes in what Allen himself is saying about them. And I was faced, you know, with sort of how do you when someone like that has played such a major role in making you the kind of artist that you are, well, what does that say about you, and what does that say about your act? So there was a lot of soul searching for me around that time, and then you think, well, yeah, and how do I kind of move on? And you know, luckily, I'm outside of those early years of my comedy career when your influences exert a much greater pull on you.
Uh-huh.
So I would say I've been doing my own thing for a while now. But it's jarring. So I would say that kind of loss stops you up much more than just, you know, the kind of pure sadness of losing someone like Robin Williams.
Yeah, and I think you alluded to this, but this is your 10th year as a comedian. Is that right? As a stand-up?
Yeah, I started doing stand-up at the end of summer of 2004. So we did a little 10-year anniversary show at the Laugh Gallery at Havana, which the Laugh Gallery is the first show that I ever did back when it was at El Cocal.
Uh-huh.
That's 10 years now.
And then you're still doing stand-up. I know you're doing that this weekend.
I am. I'm going to be emceeing this weekend for Mark Forward at the Comedy Mix. Mark Forward is a very, very funny stand-up from Toronto, and so I'm looking forward to the weekend. And I'll be hosting a show called the East Van Opry on Sunday night at the Rio. I'm not doing as much stand-up as I would like to, between teaching and some of the writing gigs. It's one of those things where as soon as I have a bit more time again, I'm hoping to fill that space again with stage time. Although I must say that the scarcity of my stage time this fall has really made me appreciate the bits of it that I have had, and so it's a lot of it feels really good still to be up there.
Yeah.
I had a bit of a falter about a year and a half ago. I just my dad got very sick around this time that I was at Just for Laughs, and he was supposed to come out to Montreal, and he couldn't, and he had to cancel his trip, and it was kind of a weird confluence that really sort of took the wind out of my sails in terms of getting up on stage. And you know, I wondered if that was going to be something that was going to be in my future, you know, forever. And I've really fallen back in love with being up on stage, with telling jokes. I'm having a lot of fun talking about parenthood up on stage, and you know, I try to talk about parenthood in a way that's not you know, it's, you know, one of the kind of classic stories of how a comedian dies is, you know, he has a kid and then just, you know, everything's diapers. but I do think that I'm bringing the same kind of political sensibility or sort of social sensibility to raising a kid, and what I'd like to do is, you know, I would say at this point I'm at about 30, 35 minutes of material on that.
Yeah.
I'd like to get to about 45 minutes and then book a little theater and record an album of kind of themed parenthood stand-up and get that up on iTunes.
So, I mean, you also have the web series. I understand you have a third book coming out, the book on essays. Is that right?
There's a book of essays, yeah, coming out from Douglas and McIntyre next fall. It's a book of humor essays. The idea is that I'm going to try and write a funny essay about a horrible or terrible thing for every letter of the alphabet. The book is called The Horrors, and it comes out from Douglas and McIntyre next fall. The web series with Sean Cullen, we filmed that last year. It came out late last spring, beginning of the summer. Unfortunately, we released it on the same day as the World Cup started because we're idiots. That's Willpower is the name of the web series, and that was a lot of fun to do, and I was really happy with how it turned out. Five little episodes, so just kind of a quick hit, but I'd love to do more stuff like that as well.
Yeah, it was very good. Yeah.
Oh, thanks very much.
Yeah. So it is a good time for you, isn't it? I mean, it's a busy time, but I mean, you've got so much stuff going on, especially with the panto and.
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff going on. It's been a tough year. It's been a tough year personally. My dad is still recovering, and we had a flood at our house, and we've been, you know, raising our first child, and I definitely signed on for a bit more than I could handle safely, work wise. But I'm always very grateful for the opportunities. I'm writing a one man show that goes up. For some preview shows in March, at the end of March in Burnaby, that I'll be taking to the Winnipeg Comedy Festival in April, and it's a lot of stuff on my plate, but I'm really happy to have all of it there, and it's just a matter of figuring out how to power through it, and then, while also making sure to take time to savor it. That's the nice thing about, well, one of the nice things about the panto is that when you write a play, there's a point where your role as an active participant in the project kind of melts away, and on opening night, I'm going to be able to just sit in the audience like everybody else and take it in and enjoy it. I'll maybe be a bit more nervous than the rest of the audience. I'll be watching how jokes land and whether they like it. Last year I got really lucky because on opening night I was sitting right in front of one of the contractors who had worked on the York refurbishing.
Oh, yeah.
And he was a hearty laugher, and he was really, really into the show, so that definitely helped. I'm hoping they get similarly, you know, serendipitously seated this year.
Well, we'll be down to see it, and if it's like last year's thing, it'll be a riot, and it'll be fun, and it'll be a great show for this time of year especially, and so congratulations on everything, and break a leg, as they say.
Thanks so much, Joe. I appreciate it.
The Cult presents Theater Replacement Cinderella and East Van Panto. That's at the York Theater from the 3rd of December to the 28th. Opening night is on Friday the 5th. Visit tickets.thecults.com for tickets, obviously. The show's playwright, Charles Demers, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.